He had never imagined anything here could be as beautiful as that shattered red horizon and the purple and ochre cliffs. Beyond the landing field, where the night's faint dew had touched life into the hurried seeds of Arrakis, he saw great puddles of red blooms, and, running through them, an articulate tread of violet, like giant footsteps.
"It's a beautiful morning, sire," the guard said.
"Yes, it is."
The Duke nodded, thinking,
"Perhaps this planet could grow on one. Perhaps it could become a good home for my son."
Then he saw the human figures moving into the flower fields, sweeping them with strange scythe-like devices. Dew-gatherers. Water so precious here that even the dew must be collected.
"And it could be a hideous place," the Duke thought.
"There is probably no more terrible instant of enlightenment than the one in which you discover your father is a man, with human flesh."
From Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. The Duke said,
"Paul, I'm doing a hateful thing, but I must."
He stood beside the portable poison snooper that had been brought into the conference room for their breakfast. The thing's sensor arms hung limply over the table, reminding Paul of some weird insect newly dead. The Duke's attention was directed out the windows at the landing field and its roiling of dust against the morning sky. Paul had a viewer in front of him containing a short film clip on Fremen religious practices. The clip had been compiled by one of Hawat's experts, and Paul found himself disturbed by the references to himself.
"Mahdi! Lizan al-Ghaib!"
He could close his eyes and recall the shouts of the crowds.
"So that is what they hope," he thought.
And he remembered what the old Reverend Mother had said, "Kwisatz Haderach." The memories touched his feelings of terrible purpose, shading this strange world with sensations of familiarity that he could not understand.
"A hateful thing," the Duke said.
"What do you mean, sir?"
Leto turned, looked down at his son.
"Because the Harkonnens think to trick me by making me distrust your mother. They don't know that I'd sooner distrust myself."
"I don't understand, sir."
Again, Leto looked out the windows. The white sun was well up into its morning quadrant. Milky light picked out a boiling of dust clouds that spilled over into the blind canyons interfingering the shield wall. Slowly, speaking in a slow voice to contain his anger, the Duke explained to Paul about the mysterious note.
"You might just as well mistrust me," Paul said.
"They have to think they've succeeded," the Duke said. "They must think me this much of a fool. It must look real. Even your mother may not know the sham."
"But, sir, why?"
"Your mother's response must not be an act. Oh, she's capable of a supreme act, but too much rides on this. I hope to smoke out a traitor. It must seem that I've been completely cozened. She must be hurt this way that she does not suffer greater hurt."
"Why do you tell me, father? Maybe I'll give it away."
"They'll not watch you in this thing," the Duke said. "You'll keep the secret. You must."
He walked to the windows, spoke without turning.
"This way, if anything should happen to me, you can tell her the truth, that I never doubted her, not for the smallest instant. I should want her to know this."
Paul recognized the death thoughts in his father's words, spoke quickly.
"Nothing's going to happen to you, sir."
"Be silent, son."
Paul stared at his father's back, seeing the fatigue in the angle of the neck, in the line of the shoulders, in the slow movements.
"You're just tired, father."
"I am tired," the Duke agreed. "I'm morally tired. The melancholy degeneration of the great houses has afflicted me at last, perhaps. And we were such strong people once."
Paul spoke in quick anger.
"Our house hasn't degenerated."
"Hasn't it?"
The Duke turned, faced his son, revealing dark circles beneath hard eyes, a cynical twist of mouth.
"I should wed your mother, make her my duchess. Yet my unwedded state gives some houses hope they may yet ally with me through their marriageable daughters."
He shrugged.
"So I..."
"Mother has explained this to me."
"Nothing wins more loyalty for a leader than an air of bravura," the Duke said. "I therefore cultivate an air of bravura."
"You lead well," Paul protested. "You govern well. Men follow you willingly and love you."
"My propaganda corps is one of the finest," the Duke said.
Again he turned to stare out at the basin.
"There's greater possibility for us here on Arrakis than the Imperium could ever suspect. Yet sometimes I think it'd have been better if we'd run for it, gone renegade. Sometimes I wish we could sink back into anonymity among the people, become less exposed to...
Father!
Yes, I am tired, the Duke said. Did you know we're using spice residue as raw material and already have our own factory to manufacture film base?
Sir?
We mustn't run short of film base, the Duke said. Else, how could we flood village and city with our information? The people must learn how well I govern them. How would they know if we didn't tell them?
You should get some rest, Paul said.
Again, the Duke faced his son. Arrakis has another advantage I almost forgot to mention. Spice is in everything here. You breathe it and eat it in almost everything. And I find that this imparts a certain natural immunity to some of the most common poisons of the Assassin's Handbook. And the need to watch every drop of water puts all food production, yeast culture, hydroponics, chemovit, everything, under the strictest surveillance. We cannot kill off large segments of our population with poison, and we cannot be attacked this way either. Arrakis makes us moral and ethical. Paul started to speak, but the Duke cut him off, saying, I have to have someone I can say these things to, son. He sighed, glanced back at the dry landscape where even the flowers were gone now, trampled by the dew-gatherers, wilted under the early sun. On Caladan we ruled with sea and air power, the Duke said. Here we must scrabble for desert power. This is your inheritance, Paul. What is to become of you if anything happens to me? You'll not be a renegade house, but a guerrilla house, running, hunted. Paul groped for words, could find nothing to say. He had never seen his father this despondent. To hold Arrakis, the Duke said, one is faced with decisions that may cost one his self-respect. He pointed out the window to the Atreides' green and black banner hanging limply from a staff at the edge of the landing field. That honorable banner could come to mean many evil things. Paul swallowed in a dry throat. His father's words carried futility, a sense of fatalism that left the boy with an empty feeling in his chest. The Duke took an anti-fatigue tablet from a pocket, gulped it dry. Power and fear, he said. The tools of statecraft. I must order new emphasis on guerrilla training for you. That film clip there, they call you Mahdi, Lizan al-Ghaib. As a last resort, you might capitalize on that. Paul stared at his father, watching the shoulder straighten as the tablet did its work, but remembering the words of fear and doubt. What's keeping that ecologist? The Duke muttered. I told Thufir to have him here early.
My father, the Padishah Emperor, took me by the hand one day, and I sensed in the ways my mother had taught me that he was disturbed. He led me down the Hall of Portraits to the ego-likeness of the Duke Leto Atreides. I marked the strong resemblance between them, my father and this man in the portrait, both with thin, elegant faces and sharp features dominated by cold eyes.
Princess daughter, my father said, I would that you'd been older when it came time for this man to choose a woman.
My father was 71 at the time, and looking no older than the man in the portrait, and I was but 14, yet I remember deducing in that instant that my father secretly wished the Duke had been his son, and disliked the political necessities that made them enemies.
In my father's house, by the Princess Irulan. His first encounter with the people he had been ordered to betray left Dr. Kynes shaken. He prided himself on being a scientist to whom legends were merely interesting clues, pointing toward cultural roots. Yet the boy fitted the ancient prophecy so precisely. He had the questing eyes and the air of reserved candor. Of course, the prophecy left certain latitude as to whether the mother goddess would bring the Messiah with her or produce him on the scene. Still, there was this odd correspondence between prediction and persons. They met in mid-morning outside the Arrakeen Landing Field's administration building. An unmarked ornithopter squatted nearby, humming softly on standby like a somnolent insect. An Atreides guard stood beside it with bared sword and the faint air distortion of a shield around him. Kynes sneered at the shield pattern, thinking, Arrakis has a surprise for them there. The planetologist raised a hand, signaled for his Fremen guard to fall back. He strode on ahead toward the building's entrance, the dark hole in plastic-coated rock. So exposed, that monolithic building, he thought, so much less suitable than a cave. Movement within the entrance caught his attention. He stopped, taking the moment to adjust his robe and the set of his stillsuit at the left shoulder. The entrance doors swung wide. Atreides guards emerged swiftly, all of them heavily armed, slow pellet stunners, swords, and shields. Behind them came a tall man, hawk-faced, dark of skin and hair. He wore a Jubba cloak with Atreides' crest at the breast, and wore it in a way that betrayed his unfamiliarity with the garment. It clung to the legs of his still suit on one side. It lacked a free-swinging, striding rhythm. Beside the man walked a youth with the same dark hair, but rounder in the face. The youth seemed small for the 15 years Kynes knew him to have. But the young body carried a sense of command, a poised assurance, as though he saw and knew things all around him that were not visible to others. And he wore the same style cloak as his father, yet with the casual ease that made one think the boy had always worn such clothing. "The Mahdi will be aware of things others cannot see," went the prophecy. Kynes shook his head, telling himself, "They're just people." With the two, garbed like them for the desert, came a man Kynes recognized, Gurney Halleck. Kynes took a deep breath to still his resentment against Halleck, who had briefed him on how to behave with the Duke and ducal heir. "You may call the Duke my lord or sire. Noble-born also is correct, but usually reserved for more formal occasions. The son may be addressed as young master or my lord. The Duke is a man of much leniency, but brooks little familiarity." And Kynes thought as he watched the group approach, "They'll learn soon enough who's master on Arrakis. Order me questioned half the night by that mentat, will they? Expect me to guide them on an inspection of spice mining, do they?" The import of Howitt's questions had not escaped Kynes. They wanted the Imperial bases, and it was obvious they'd learned of the bases from Idaho. "I will have Stilgar send Idaho's head to this Duke," Kynes told himself. The ducal party was only a few paces away now, their feet in desert boots crunching the sand. Kynes bowed. "My lord Duke?" As he had approached the solitary figure standing near the ornithopter, Leto had studied him. Tall, thin, dressed for the desert in loose robe, stillsuit, and low boots. The man's hood was thrown back, its veil hanging to one side, revealing long sandy hair, a sparse beard. The eyes were that fathomless blue within blue under thick brows. Remains of dark stains smudged his eye sockets. "You're the ecologist," the Duke said. "We prefer the old title here, my lord," Kynes said. "Planetologist." "As you wish," the Duke said. He glanced down at Paul. "Son, this is the judge of the change, the arbiter of dispute, the man set here to see that the forms are obeyed in our assumption of power over this fief." He glanced at Kynes. "And this is my son." "My lord," Kynes said. "Are you a Fremen?" Paul asked. Kynes smiled. "I am accepted in both Siege and Village, young master, but I am in His Majesty's service, the Imperial Planetologist." Paul nodded, impressed by the man's air of strength. Halleck had pointed Kynes out to Paul from an upper window of the administration building. "The man standing there with the Fremen escort, the one moving now toward the ornithopter." Paul had inspected Kynes briefly with binoculars, noting the prim, straight mouth, the high forehead. Halleck had spoken in Paul's ear. "Odd sort of fellow. He has a precise way of speaking. Clipped off. No fuzzy edges. Razor apt." And the Duke behind them had said, "Scientist type." Now, only a few feet from the man, Paul sensed the power in Kynes, the impact of personality, as though he were blood royal, born to command. "I understand we have you to thank for our still suits and these cloaks," the Duke said. "I hope they fit well, my lord," Kynes said. "They're of Fremen make, and as near as possible the dimensions given me by your man Halleck here." "I was concerned that you said you couldn't take us into the desert unless we wore these garments," the Duke said. "We can carry plenty of water. We don't intend to be out long, and we'll have air cover. The escort you see overhead right now. It isn't likely we'd be forced down." Kynes stared at him, seeing the water-fat flesh. He spoke coldly. "You never talk of likelihoods on Arrakis. You speak only of possibilities." Halleck stiffened. "The Duke is to be addressed as my lord or sire." Leto gave Halleck their private hand signal to desist, said, "Our ways are new here, Gurney. We must make allowances." "As you wish, sire." "We are indebted to you, Dr. Kynes," Leto said. "These suits and the consideration for our welfare will be remembered." On impulse, Paul called to mind a quotation from the O.C. Bible, said, "The gift is the blessing of the river." The words rang out overloud in the still air. The Fremen escort Kynes had left in the shade of the administration building leaped up from their squatting repose, muttering in open agitation.